This is the Paula Gordon Show, conversations with people at the leading edge, of whom Susan Faludi certainly is one. Bill Russell and I are delighted to be with you, Ms. Faludi.
Thank you. Likewise.
The idea that women's voices were, some women's voices were hushed, were savaged. Mm-hmm. And you give the wonderful, the terrifying example of Barbara Kingsolver, who was quoted over and over again, misquoted. And things she never said, and yet the savagery was very real in attacking what she had not said.
Right.
And at the same time, you have the radical right-wing extremists who were enhancing their fundamentalist perspective that women should be seen and not heard.
Except for right-wing women.
Right.
I mean, when you go back and look, there was a dramatic decline in women's voices after 9/11 on op-ed pages. On talk shows.
And you went through and did the numbers on this.
Right. And a number of other activist or media monitoring organizations did the numbers as well. For example, the White House Project, which is a women's rights advocacy group. And it just so happened they were monitoring on the Sunday morning, those important Sunday morning policy talk shows. And after 9/11, they noticed that the percentage of women guests dropped by 40% to a total of less than 10%.
And the two women who could have genuinely informed us were kept out of that conversation.
Right. The excuse given the producers was, well, this is, we're in a time of war, and, you know, apparently women are not involved. But here, Senators Feinstein and Boxer, just to give one example, who were both at the time heads of congressional subcommittees dealing with terrorism, were nowhere to be seen on these shows.
That's nuts.
Well, and it wasn't just the talk shows. It was all over the place. However, you did, well, the one place where you did see a lot of women were conservative to right-wing women who were towing the party line, and they were happily invited on. But as you point out, those who had a different point of view, for like Barbara Kingsolver, were just hounded in a way that you wouldn't think imaginable in a democratic
press. Wouldn't do to a woman, much less within the democracy, right, of which we have claimed.
With Barbara Kingsolver, her first piece simply said things like, maybe we could gain a few, you know, hard-won truths out of this ordeal, and perhaps a capacity for mercy would be a good thing. And for this, she was called, you know, an idiot, a traitor.
This in a Christian nation,
nominally
Christian nation.
Yeah, turning the other cheek was not on the table at this point.
But the whole, it's not just turning the other cheek, it's everything that Jesus, I mean, I found myself somewhere in this thing of Bob Funk. Robert Funk, who started the Jesus Seminar, late Robert Funk, started the Jesus Seminar to find out what Jesus really said as opposed to what was put in his mouth. And he said, on the basis of his research and in response to it, he had concluded that a lot of people, and perhaps even the majority, you know, if it came down to Jesus or Christianity, Jesus would have to go. That the historical Jesus, the Jesus of the Beatitudes, of forgiveness, basically love your neighbor, love God. But the first one, in some ways, was, and the hard one was love your neighbor. That went away, and I had a lot of the same sense that you have all this empty rhetoric going on that violates. We talked about the terrorist attacking the American values. Mm-hmm. So what do? We have the media and the administration and most the chattering classes and certainly a majority of the politicians, either out of cowardice or out of misguided belief, undermining American values. Mm-hmm. I mean, pretty much uniformly.
That's what you found, wasn't it?
Well, what you find is, on the one hand, individual Americans who may be struggling with what's really going on in their own private and, responsible and even courageous ways. And then you've got the culture as a whole, which lies over us like a cement blanket, that silences those individual gropings toward truth and reality. It really struck me the other day. I was at the New York Historical Society, which has just opened an exhibit on 9/11, and they have all these photographs and testimonials from people in New York in the early days. And when you look at these, and these are just average, you know, New Yorkers, you look at these photographs, and over again you see signs being held up, you know, let this not lead us into war. There was one with a John Wayne figure, and somebody, you know, had put a sign over it, you know, this is not the direction we want to go in. And you see the same thing in the taped testimonials.
That was quite touching as you rendered it.
And yet, where did it go? I mean, because we live in a, you know, we're choked by this commercial culture that drowns out the individual human voices and drowns out, or has really wiped out an actual civic and culture, an actual public society. I mean, it used to be the culture came out of the society. Now we have a culture that is imposed on people and very little civic society to push back.
Go ahead, Mom.
The first heroes, second heroes out of this were of course, the New York City firemen. Mm-hmm.
The real ones, not the ones that pretend.
Right.
And the misrepresentation is startling, but I found myself in near the end to go back to them and their rewards for being heroes.
Mm-hmm. And quote-unquote rewards.
Well, for being heroes. Well, in a way, though, it is standard kit for what we call heroes. You know, the heroes we sent, nominal heroes we send over to Iraq, will we provide them the basics they need, body armor, armor for their vehicles? Will we take care of them when they come back? Mm. The VA fiasco, the hospital, is screamingly predictable because we've been doing this since the Civil War. We promised black people liberation if they would fight against the British in the Civil War. Mm-hmm. What did we do? As soon as the war was over, effectively back into slavery. Mm-hmm. This is a consistent theme. We make people heroes, and that effectively what we say is that's your reward because you ain't going to get anything else. And in fact, we're probably going to treat you fairly badly. And that is what's happened to the New York City firemen.
Right. Well, I mean, the New York City firefighters were asked to settle for hero worship in place of the tools and protections they needed to do their jobs
which effectively killed those people.
And as we all know, Rudy Giuliani has been trying for months now to ride this hero worship of the firefighters to the White House, and the firefighters union in New York is having none of it, saying
they shouldn't have died. If you'd taken care of us beforehand with radios.
That's right.
And we knew that from 1993.
Right, from the 1993 bombing, and even before, they knew that these radios did not work in high rises. The city leadership was supposed to replace them.
That would be Rudy Giuliani.
Among others. I mean, he's not the only one. But there was a no-bid contract made with Motorola that drove to get new radios that drove the price from 1.4 million to 14 million. They got these radios finally. They didn't work. They had to send them back. So they went back to the old radios, and it was the old radios that not only could they not hear the May Day order to get out of the towers before they collapsed, they also couldn't communicate with the police department. And the police helicopter overhead warned the police 20 minutes before the second tower fell, and yet the firefighters in the second tower heard nothing of it.
343 people who did not need to die.
Exactly. And, you know, the media and the political culture spoke for these firefighters, but if you actually go and look at and read what the firefighters said, and there are more than 500 oral history accounts that the firefighters gave the New York Fire Department, in which over and over again they talk about how victimized, how betrayed they felt by the failure of leadership, by the failure of basic equipment. And they don't define themselves as heroes in this. They define themselves as victims. You see this quote over and over again. One of the more poignant quotes was, "The only difference between us and the victims on 9/11 was that we had flashlights. And tellingly, these oral history accounts were repressed for more than 3 years by the city. It went to the highest court in the state before the city was forced to cough up these accounts. And even then, it was, you know, a one-day story.
And then when time comes to give them a raise, they will have none.
It was years before they got the raise that they had been promised. Recently did they get decent, you know, somewhat working radios.
And then you talk about the Jersey Girls, the other half of that part of the story.
Well, the ongoing litany. There are two books here. One is just the representation of the ongoing misrepresentation of fact that seems, you know, that is systematic and predictable. Part of the reason I didn't just tell Paul to turn off the television because I didn't think we'd know anything. You could see what was going to happen, given the behavior of the media to that point. That this was—you could see them just whining. Oh boy, we can—you know—we can take off our jackets and smoke cigarettes and talk all night on the air, and be the noble souls that we think we are, and that it was going to spin out of control from within 15 minutes of when the event happened. And the other, of course, was that it was clear that there were a lot of political forces that were going to use this, exploit this as an opportunity to drive forward agenda. That had nothing to do, and in fact, were antithetical to the facts of what were going on and to the facts of what were being threatened.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Bill. Before I interrupt,
and I would like Ms. Faludi to address that.
We're going to be back in just a moment. It is The Terror Dream, which Bill says rightly is in fact two books. We'll talk about both of those books, all wrapped up beautifully. Lyrically in The Terror Dream by Susan Faludi. Be with us when we return.